Whenever I sing that second verse, I always think of Ebenezer, and then the first thing that comes into my mind is Scrooge, but that's not what it's supposed to be. We're supposed to think of the beginning of 1 Samuel. Anyone else think of that? No, because of the Christmas Carol. So Charles Dickens has ruined Come Thou Fount for us. No, because Samuel, he fights against the Philistines, and they win, and they shouldn't have. They had been fighting with them all the way since the time of Samson. And after they fight, they win the battle. He serves as a deliverer for them. They put up a big rock, and they name it Ebenezer, because hitherto the Lord hath helped us. And so it puts it in that song, because we should have those moments in our life where we look back at those times where the Lord has helped us to bring us where we are, because we couldn't have got there on our own. And so that's a good verse, but it bothers me that we always miss it because we all think of the Christmas carol, so it's a shame. We're going to be in Jeremiah chapter 51. We'll see if we get through this chapter today. This is probably the longest, or at least one of the longest chapters in the book. We're almost here at the end, and this is the second half of Jeremiah's message to Babylon. And so we're going to go through this morning. If you didn't get a handout, raise your hand. We just want to make sure you have one. If you didn't get one on the way in, we'll make sure you got one down here, Brother Paul, and in the back as well. And then I think that's everybody. Anybody else? And then Miss Sarah down here, Brother Paul, as well. Very good. Very good. A lot of folks here this morning, so that's good. It's good to see you all here. We're in the second half of Jeremiah's message. And remember, this last section of the book between just the last few chapters are not a message to Judah, but they're a message to each of these individual foreign nations that are surrounding Judah. And he gives an individual message to Egypt and Moab and Edom and Damascus. And now he talks to each of them about how, in spite of the fact that Judah's going to fall, he's not overlooking what they're doing, and their nations will fall as well by the hand of this new uprising power, Babylon. And so it's very appropriate that he finishes this section by not ignoring Babylon. And not overlooking Habakkuk's frustration that Babylon's no better than any of these other nations. Why would they be victorious while everybody else falls? God uses Babylon for his purpose, but Babylon will still see justice themselves. And so he takes the last two chapters and the longest chapters of this section to talk about how Babylon will fall as well. And in this passage, he tells his people to flee from Babylon. Now, that's an interesting thing. We're going to look at that in the end of the book. But it's an interesting thing when we think about how God has to tell his people to run away from Babylon. Because you'd think that would be an easy command to follow. They don't want to be there anyway. So obviously, in the time when Babylon falls, they should want to just run away. They should be looking for the first opportunity to get away. But that's not actually what happens, because as Israel eventually goes into Babylon, they settle. Remember, God told them to settle. You're going to be here for now, so you might as well build a house. You might as well plant a vineyard. You might as well take it, because this is what it's going to be. But then when the time comes and he says, all right, now this world system will fall, you need to leave, many of them don't. What's really interesting is this is illustrated by the last few books of the Bible. Ezra, Nehemiah, not few books of the Bible, last few books of history in the Old Testament. Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther. The people of Israel, when they eventually return back home under three different groups, the first one's by Zerubbabel, the second one's by Ezra, the third one's by Nehemiah, not everybody comes. And then you have the book of Esther. And Esther's not set in Israel. Esther's set all the way over there where Babylon was, or in Persia, which has taken Babylon over. And there's a whole Jewish population there. And they're all living and working and flourishing and doing their things, and they've all settled there. The thing is, many of us, we can complain about how bad the world is, but many of us have settled in the system of the world because we're used to it. We're used to it, aren't we? We get frustrated by the bad things in this world, but even at the end of the Bible, at the very end of the Bible, in the book of Revelation, it uses Babylon, the term Babylon, to represent this evil world system. And he talks that at the end of time, Babylon, the evil world system of men and their thinking and their philosophy, it will fall. And when it falls, he tells his people that you need to leave it. I gave you that passage in Revelation chapter 18. He says he cried mightily with a strong voice, saying, Babylon the great is fallen, and has become the habitation of devils and the hold of every foul spirit and cage of every unclean and hateful bird. All nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. The kings of the earth have committed fornication with her, and the merchants of the earth are waxed rich through the abundance of her delicacies. And I heard another voice from heaven saying, Come out of her, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins, and that ye receive not of her plagues. So in the midst of Babylon, this evil nation falling, he tells his own people that they don't need to be a part of its failure. We can complain about all the sin and the debauchery of this world, but we're kind of getting used to it, aren't we? It's the way the world is. We like the entertainment and the wealth that the system provides. And sooner or later, we have to make a decision between the kingdom of heaven and the kingdoms of men. See, the Jewish people probably hated the Babylonians, but they settled and built their houses there, and they were used to its wealth, and they were used to its power. And he says, when Babylon falls, you need to let it fall, and you need to leave it. And there's going to be two parts of my message this morning. We're going to talk about what God does, and we're going to talk about what we should do in response to what God does. So the reason I said we'll see if we finish today is because I might not get past point number one, and so I'm not making any promises this morning. This is a very long passage. Also, this passage, he says a lot of things, and he reciprocates his message. And so with this particular, I don't like doing this, but with some of the points I'm going to draw out, I'm going to be hopping around the chapter a little bit, so you kind of have to hang with me. So point number one is this: God acts in the affairs of men. The point of many of these passages in Jeremiah is, let me back out even farther. The Old Testament is broken up into several different sections. You have the books of history, right? And it just tells you what happened. This happened. This guy did this, and then this happened after this. This many people died. This man took the throne. This man was evil. This man was good. This is what happened. The prophets give you more insight into why it's happening. God is doing this, and we see a little bit more of a glimpse into heaven about what God is doing in our response. And the book of Jeremiah is very much set up like this. Jeremiah doesn't just recount things that are taking place. He says, God is working these things for this reason. And if any man, the older he gets, the more he's able to step back and see that God is the one that orchestrates things in the lives of men. That's what Benjamin Franklin said. Benjamin Franklin was a deist, which means he does not believe that God works in the affairs of men. A deist believes that God created the world and then left it to run on its own. But as he got older, he says, the longer I live, the more I'm convinced of this truth that God governs the affairs of men. And we quote that and we're like, yeah, Benjamin Franklin. That was completely against his worldview. He didn't believe that God governed the affairs of men. But when he got older, he realized that it's inescapable to look at what happens and to ignore the fact that it's not us working all these things. It must be somebody else. And in these passages, it tells us this. First of all, letter A, he puts down and he sets up. He puts down and sets up. God is the one that makes people rise to power and fall. So let's start our passage. Jeremiah chapter 51, look at verse number 1. He says this, thus saith the Lord. Now, he's in the middle of his message. We talked about the first chapter last time, so we're continuing on. Thus saith the Lord, behold, I will raise up against Babylon and against them that dwell in the midst of them that rise up against me a destroying wind. And I will send unto Babylon fanners that shall fan her and shall empty her land, for in the day of trouble they shall be against her round about. Against him that bendeth, let the archer bend his bow, and against him that lifteth up himself in his brigandine. And spare ye not her young men, destroy ye utterly all her host. Thus the slain shall fall in the land of the Chaldeans, and they that are thrust through in the streets. So in this passage, he describes how this other nation, the Medes and the Persians, are going to rise to power. And he uses several illustrations in this chapter to illustrate this point. The first one here is that of threshing. Do we know what threshing is? When they would have a wheat field or a barley field, you know, we have those here, the little sprigs, and then it poof at the top, and all the seeds are in the poofs. at the top. Now here we have all kinds of machines that do all the stuff, but there they would have to beat the seeds out and they would all fall to the floor. And so you have seeds and then you have trash. And you don't want all of it. You don't want to cook bread with husk. Okay, so you want to separate those. Now the husks or the chaff was lighter than the seeds. And so they'd go to a hill or they would actually fan it manually and they would throw the seeds into the air. And if there was a slight breeze, the breeze would blow away the chaff and the seeds would fall down. You keep doing that long enough, then you just have a pile of seed or a pile of wheat or barley and not any trash. And here he's saying to the Babylonians that now is the time that they should be threshed. Now, go hop really quickly all the way down to verse 33. He picks this illustration up again. Because he talks about that he's going to give them a destroying wind, bring fanners against them. Look at verse 33. For thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, the daughter of Babylon is like a threshing floor. It is time to thresh her. Yet a little while, and the time of her harvest shall come. The thresh was to toss grain up and let the chaff drive it away, be driven away by the wind. Does that remind you of anything? Psalm 1, yes, where Jeremiah says to the Israelites that they are not like a tree planted by rivers of water. But the second half of the chapter says this, the ungodly are not so, they're not like that tree, but are like the chaff, which the wind driveth away. And he goes on, he says, therefore, the ungodly shall not stand in the judgment, nor sinners in the congregation of the righteous. For the Lord knows the way of the righteous, but the way of the ungodly shall perish. Babylon was strong and powerful. They have always been chaff. They have always been chaff. But when it was time for them to be threshed and to be driven away by the wind was when God chose it to be. He puts up and sets down. Babylon wasn't powerful. They were never not chaff. It was just up to God where he chose to thresh them and let the wind drive them away. And here he says, it's time to thresh them. And the fanners will fan them, and they will be driven away. Babylon was not strong because they were strong. Babylon was strong because God had just not threshed them yet. That was it. And for us, we solidify ourselves in our own stability, and if we're not living righteously, we're just buying time until the moment that God allows us to be blown away with the wind. That's one illustration he gives of them. Another illustration he gives of them is that of water. Look at verse 11. Verse 11. Make bright the arrows. That's an interesting phrase, by the way. It's actually not as complicated as you think it is. If you have a piece of metal and it's dull, what did you have to do to make it shiny again? Sharpen it. So you have arrows, they sharpened their arrows. That's all that it means. Gather the shields. The Lord hath raised up the spirit of the kings of the Medes, the Median Empire. For his device is against Babylon, to destroy it, because it is the vengeance of the Lord, the vengeance of his temple. Set up the standard upon the walls of Babylon. Make the watch strong. Set up the watchmen. Prepare the ambushes. For the Lord hath both devised and done that which he spake against the inhabitants of Babylon. O thou that dwellest upon many waters, abundant in treasures, thine end is come and the measure of thy covetousness. Now, throughout the Bible, and especially in the book of Revelation, waters are a picture of groups and nations of people. So to be above the waters, to be on many waters, is to be over many peoples. And so he says to Babylon that God has devised against them through the Medes and the Persians that they are going to fall in spite of the fact that they were people over many waters. Now I want you to go down to verse 41. Go down to verse 41. I just think it's ironic he describes them as people over many waters. And then later on he says this, verse 41. How Shishak is taken. That's another way that the Bible sometimes refers to Babylon. So we won't get into that, but that's what that is. And how the praise of the whole earth surprised. We talked about that. Sometimes the nations were surprised, like Damascus. How is the city of my joy fallen? We don't know what's going on. Surprised. How has Babylon become an astonishment among the nations? The sea is come up upon Babylon. She is covered with the multitudes of the waves thereof. And her cities are a desolation, a dry land, a wilderness, a land wherein no man dwelleth, neither doth any son of man pass thereby. It's such an ironic picture. Babylon was over many waters, many nations of people. And here he says, now those same waves will come and wash them away. Like the tide rises and takes them away and comes over them. And I also think there's other irony. Do you see that? The waves are going to come against them, and he says, and they will become a dry land. I just thought that was so ironic. They're not even wet when it finishes. They're dry after the waves take them over. So he uses this picture of the waves coming and swelling and taking them over. My wife and I, when we were on vacation a couple weeks ago, we were somewhere, I don't know where we were, Jekyll Island. Where is that? Is that in Georgia? Okay. We were in Jekyll Island, and we went there briefly because Sam wanted to go see the Driftwood Beach. Okay. So we drove, and we saw the Driftwood Beach. And we got there, and it was the most surreal, one of the most surreal places I've been. It looked like something straight out of like an apocalyptic moment in a movie. You, as far as the eye could see, were all of these grand and giant trees in the water. It was like over the years, for whatever reason, Jekyll Island's very low, the tide had risen. And so this forest is now in the sea. And so it's all dead, and it's all fallen over. And as far as the eye can see, you see all these trees about 20 feet inside the waves, and they're all falling over, they're all rotting, and they're all massive pieces of driftwood, as far as you can see. And the waves had come up, and so it had been established, and the waves had come up and taken it over and killed it all. So it looked really cool in the pictures, but it was kind of a sad moment at the same time. This is kind of the picture he gives of Babylon. Babylon had taken dominion over the waters, and now the water had come over and taken over them. And it's all because God is the one that allows it. The terminology in this whole passage is that God is the one that set them up, and now God is the one that's taking them down. Psalm 75 says this, God is the judge. He putteth down one, and he setteth up another. So, letter B. He strengthens or weakens. God strengthens or weakens. It is not that we strengthen ourselves, it is that God allows us to have the strength to do what he wants us to do. Now, we have to ask the question about why Babylon was so strong in the first place. I mean, as you're reading through the Old Testament, there's this constant battle between people, and they're all picking a fight at each other, and Israel's fighting with Judah, and then they get together against Moab, and then they fight with Edom, and then they're friends with Edom, and then Syria's picking at them the whole time during the reign of Ahab, and following in the time of Jehu, and then Assyria rises up, and they're all fighting with, and then Babylon comes, and they just kind of, and everyone's just done. And it's odd, too, because when you study history, Babylon was nobody about 100 years before this. They were a little city-state all the way south from the Euphrates River, and they were an old place. There was an old empire of Babylon. If you've ever heard the name Hammurabi and his law code, that was from old Babylon. But it was long gone. It had lost its power and influence. And then Nebuchadnezzar's dad goes there, Nabopolassar, and he's like, let's make something out of this. And they just take over the world in like one campaign. It's the weirdest thing. There's no really rhyme or reason for it. Their way of conquering was actually not much different than Assyria's. And their way of conquering wasn't sustainable. They would take over people and then consume their identity and their land and take them captive or occupy the nation. You can only do that so many times. And they did. They got to a place where they capped themselves. Persia had a different philosophy. They'd go in and they'd let them have independent identity, and so they could get a little bigger. Greece changed their culture for them, so you're not you anymore, you are us now. Babylon's way of conquering wasn't sustainable. Why did they take so much power? Because God gave them the strength to do it. That's the only reason why. And when God chooses not to give them the strength, then they won't have power anymore. Here we see, talking about Persia, he says he's going to give them the strength to do it. Look at verse number 20. Verse 20. He says, thou art my battle axe and weapons of war. He's talking about Persia now, taking over Babylon. For with thee will I break in pieces the nations, and with thee will I destroy kingdoms. With thee will I break in pieces the horse and his rider, and with thee will I break in pieces the chariot and his rider. With thee also will I break in pieces man and woman, and with thee will I break in pieces old and young. And with thee will I break in pieces the young man and the maid. I will also break in pieces with thee the shepherd and his flock. And with thee will I break in pieces the husbandman and his yoke of oxen, and with thee will I break in pieces captains and rulers. So he reminds you every phrase of what he's going to do. The two things are happening. He's going to use people, but ultimately he's the one that's doing it. With thee will I do this. With thee will I do these things. He gave Persia the power to break Babylon. And on the flip side, what about Babylon and all of its might? And all their weapons of war, and all their armies that just took the whole world by storm all in one generation. What's going to happen to them? Verse 30. The mighty men of Babylon have forborne to fight. They've remained in their holds. Their might hath failed. They became as women. They've burned her dwelling places. Her bars are broken. One post, a messenger, shall run to meet another. And one messenger to meet another, to show the king of Babylon that his city is taken at one end. The passages are stopped, the reeds they have burned with fire, and the men of war are affrighted. This is what it sounds like all these other little nations that we talked about earlier. They didn't have any power to fight. They're hiding in their holds. They are afraid. Doesn't sound like Babylon, does it? But God didn't give them strength now, so they don't have any. The messengers are passing message from person to tell the king that the city is taken. I told you there was three illustrations about how he talks about Babylon's strength being failed. One is that he's going to make them like chaff, that they're going to be driven away. The other one is that water is going to come and going to sweep them over, though they were over many waters. The third one, he uses an illustration of a lion. I want you to look at it. Look at verse 38. Verse 38. He is talking about Babylon. He says, they shall roar together like lions. They shall yell as lions' whelps. And in their heat, I will make their feasts, and I will make them drunken, that they may rejoice and sleep a perpetual sleep and not wake, saith the Lord. And I will bring them down like lambs to the slaughter, like rams with he-goats. By the way, our fellows are coming by. If you could take your attendance slip, just make sure your name's on it. Give that to them. We'd appreciate that. So he uses an easy illustration. Young lions, they'll pounce on the prey and then they'll eat. And then as they're eating their prey, they sit back and they relax like everything's fine. And now they have become the prey because they're too busy trusting in their own strength. He says these young lions have now become lambs for slaughter. He gave them the strength and now he has taken it away. When they fall, they'll fall like lambs. They will try their best, but without God's help, it is futile. Go down to verse 52. Verse 52. Wherefore, behold, the days come, saith the Lord, that I will do judgment upon her graven images, and through all her land the wounded shall groan. Though Babylon shall mount up to heaven, and though she should fortify the height of her strength, yet from me shall spoilers come unto her, saith the Lord. A sound of cry cometh from Babylon, and great destruction from the land of the Chaldeans, because the Lord hath spoiled Babylon. Destroyed out of her the great voice, when her waves do roar like great waters, the noise of their voice is uttered. Because the spoiler, that's somebody who comes and takes what they have, the spoiler has come upon her, even unto Babylon. Her mighty men are taken, every one of their bows is broken. For the Lord God of recompenses shall surely requite. I will make drunk her princes and her wise men, her captains and her rulers, her mighty men, and they shall sleep a perpetual sleep and not wake, saith the king, whose name is the Lord of hosts. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, the broad walls of Babylon shall be broken, and her high gates shall be burned with fire. The people shall labor in vain, and the folk in the fire, and they shall be weary. He describes them, what he's doing as making them drunken. Notice that? He did it twice. When we're drunk, we're not able to focus, pay attention, to do what we need to do. We don't have the wherewithal to operate. And he says, I'm going to make them drunken. Where suddenly their own independent ability to take care of themselves and to figure it out and to make the right decisions and go where they need to go and to give the commands they need to make. They don't know where to go. They can't focus. They're unable to pay attention because God is the one that gives them the power to do that. We have to ask the question, obviously looking into history, how some things happen the way that they do. I mean, look at the American Revolution, right? There's no reason why we should have won against the world power. I mean, we didn't really have a standing army. The whole Minutemen idea was the men of the colonies came. Well, it was American spirit. Stop. That doesn't make bullets more effective. Because the British people call it British spirit. I don't know. We don't live there, so we don't talk about British patriotism. We don't know how they feel. The fact is, we want to take credit for it, but the only reason that one power defeats another is because God lets them. And that's what Babylon, that's what this passage reminds us of. A few passages ago, Babylon is the one in Persia. Shoot is in this passage. But he flips it, and God is the one that does it. Through you, God says, I will do this. But just as God brings people up, he can tear them down. We must be careful not to view ourselves as special or privileged or even entitled to the strength that we've been given by God. Because it was never our strength in the first place. Because it is God who is strong, not us. And he gives strength to the one who he wills to give strength to. The Bible says in Isaiah 40, he gives power to the faint. To them that have no might, he increases strength. Even the youth shall faint and be weary, and the young men shall utterly fall. But they that wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings as eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. What's the significance of the youths and the young men? Those are the guys you send to war. The young guys. The guys that are 18 to, you know, the early 30s. Those are the young men that you want to send out because they have natural strength. And he says they're going to faint and be weary. Well, then how do I get strength? If you wait on the Lord, he'll give you strength. He says, your physical ability to take care of yourself is not sufficient. But if our spiritual life is in place, he will give us the strength that we need to do what he wants us to do. God strengthens and God weakens whom he will. And so when we want to look back at all the strength that we have never had strength of our own. All power is the Lord's. So if power has been given, it comes from him. And just as easily as it can be given, it can be taken away. He strengthens and weakens. Let her see. He judges and punishes righteously. Righteously. This might be one of the most consistent principles throughout this book, that God is justified in doing what he does. Regardless of the fact that we don't always know why God does what he does, although this book gives us more insight into that, we do know there is always a good reason because God always does what is right. It doesn't matter that Babylon was used by God to bring judgment on the world, God would take care of them as well. So go back to verse 24. I'll read several passages in this chapter that reminds us of this very truth, and we'll move on. We're probably only going to get through point number one, so I'll have to just be okay with that. Look at verse 24. I will render unto Babylon and to all the inhabitants of Chaldea all their evil that they have done in Zion in your sight, saith the Lord. Behold, I am against thee, O destroying mountain, saith the Lord, which destroyest all the earth. And I will stretch out mine hand upon thee and roll thee down from the rocks, and I will make thee a burnt mountain. The idea of this picture, he will choose to drop them off the cliff if he wants to. They shall not take of thee a stone for a corner or a stone for foundations, but thou shalt be desolate forever, saith the Lord. It's a fascinating picture. Or probably don't catch it. He's imagining this giant rock that falls off of a cliff, and when it gets to the bottom, it shatters. And rocks have value to build with. If you have a foundation stone, so you have to be good and solid and stable and square. And the best foundation stone you can find, you would use as your cornerstone to build with. So a broken rock still has a lot of value. But here he says, I will roll them off the cliff, and no one will use any of the pieces for a corner or for a foundation stone, because it will all just be shards of stone. None of it is valuable anymore. So it's an interesting picture that we might miss. Verse 27, set ye up a standard in the land, blow the trumpet among the nations, prepare the nations against her, call together against her the kingdoms of Ararat, Minai, Ashkenaz, and appoint a captain against her. Cause the horses to come up as the rough caterpillars. He uses caterpillars several times in this passage. The idea is a swarm of people that will come against them. He says it a couple times, so you'll see that. Prepare against her the nations with the kings of the Medes, the captains thereof, and all the rulers thereof, and all the land of his dominion. But all these things he's doing, he says, he is against them because he's going to render to them according to the works they gave to others. Go down to verse 34. Verse 34, Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, hath devoured me. He hath crushed me. He hath made me an empty vessel. He hath swallowed me up like a dragon. He hath filled his belly with my delicates. He hath cast me out. So Israel is talking about all the things he has done and the violence done to me. Verse 35, and to my flesh be upon Babylon, shall the inhabitants of Zion say, and my blood upon the inhabitants of Chaldea, shall Jerusalem say. So what he has done to them will be done back. Verse 36, therefore thus saith the Lord, behold, I will plead thy cause and take vengeance for her, for thee. I will dry up her sea and make her springs dry. Babylon shall become heaps, a dwelling place for dragons, an astonishment and a hissing without inhabitants. He will plead their cause. God will stand as the lawyer against Babylon and stand as the prosecutor, and he will say that, and he will point out the sins that they have so that judgment can be given out. Go down to verse 44. Verse 44. I will punish Bel, one of their gods, in Babylon. I will bring forth out of his mouth that which he had swallowed up. The nations shall not flow together any more unto him. Yea, the wall of Babylon shall fail. Look at verse 48. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, verse 48. Then the heaven and the earth and all that is in there that is therein shall sing for Babylon, for the spoilers shall come unto her from the north, saith the Lord. As Babylon hath caused the slain of Israel to fall, so at Babylon shall fall the slain of all the earth. So we could talk about this for a while, but here we see plainly that God is recompensing to them on their own heads that which they gave out to others. Babylon deserved what they would see. Everything that they had done to everybody else, and so it would come back to them. At the end of the day, and at the end of the Bible, and I'm not going to re-preach any message from the book of Revelation, but I already said that at the end of the Bible, Revelation 17, 18, and 19, or even 16, describes this evil world system and uses the term Babylon to define it. And when it falls, he tells his people to rejoice because it needs to. This world system and all of its wickedness and its opposition to God can only last so long. And anything bad that happens to it is something that they have done to themselves, not something that we can then turn around and say, why, God, did you do this? Because it's only biding time. Like I said at the beginning, the world and its system has always been chaff, and it's only waiting until the moment that God says it's time to thresh, because it'll just blow away in the wind. That takes me to my last point, and we'll be done. I'll finish early. You're welcome. Letter D. He is in charge. He is in charge. What this passage shows us is that all these things, and the rising and falling of nations, Judah falling, Moab falling, Babylon rising, Babylon falling, the Persians rising, the Persians are going to fall, and Greece is going to rise, and then Greece is going to fall, and Rome is going to rise. These people are not who are in charge. God is the one that is in charge. Look at verse number 12. Look at verse 12. He's saying to the Medes, set up the standard upon the walls of Babylon. Make the watch strong. God's commanding an army to march against Babylon, and he says to put up your standard. We know what a standard is. A standard is a flag or a symbol on a pole that represents a group or an army. We understand this today because that's what happens at a fort, right? You raise the flag. And as long as the flag is raised, that's who's in charge of the fort. We were down at Fort Sumter, which is in South Carolina. Sam gives a big itinerary, so I never know where I am. I just drive. But we went to Fort Sumter, and I didn't realize how significant it was, but of course that was hugely significant during the Civil War, named after a previous general, and they built it because of the Revolutionary War, the War of 1812, and so they didn't know if they were going to have a conflict with Britain again, so they built several forts, and they didn't realize they were going to use it when they fought with themselves, but But they did, and this was a constant area of conflict throughout the entire Civil War, Union and Confederates fighting for Charleston. And they fought consistently, and there's several stories where as they were bombarding Fort Sumter with bombs several times, the standard, the flag, fell. And they hastily got it together, and they took rough nails and nailed it to a post so they could put it back up again, because the standard cannot fall, because that represents who's in charge. Of course, we all know the story of the Star-Spangled Banner, right? Francis Scott Key in the boat looking over and watching and hoping to see the standard still flying in the morning. And oh, say, can you see by the dawn's early light? There the flag still waves. And so the standard was important. Of course, we've all seen the picture of Iwo Jima, right? With the battle that's raging and then those guys all gathering together to raise the flag on the island. Because the standard represented who was in charge. And here we have God saying to one nation, you get to put your standard up now. The nation didn't choose to put up its own standard. God chose whose standard was up and whose was not. God raised the flags, and he raises whose flag? He will. And that word standard shows up again in God's language, him choosing who's going to be in charge. Because at the end of the day, the Medes weren't in charge. The Persians weren't in charge. God was. Look at verse number 14. In the middle of this passage, we have this brief description at the very beginning here of how powerful God is. And it almost seems random and out of place. Look down at it. Verse 14. The Lord of hosts has sworn by himself, saying, surely I'll fill thee with men as with caterpillars. There's the swarm of bugs again, picturing the army of men. They shall lift up a shout against thee. Now look at this. He hath made the earth by his power. He hath established the world by his wisdom, and has stretched out the heaven by his understanding. When he uttereth his voice, there's a multitude of waters in the heavens. He causeth the vapors to ascend from the ends of the earth. He maketh lightnings with rain, and bringeth forth the wind out of his treasures. Every man is brutish by his knowledge. That means stupid, by the way. That's a very fancy King James word to say stupid. He's brutish by his own knowledge. Every founder is confounded by the graven image. For his molten image is falsehood. There is no breath in them. Everything that man can make is not very good. So we have a God that is, and then we have the gods that we can make. A founder is somebody who crafts his own metal. And he makes a god, and it can't do anything because it's made out of metal. It has eyes, but it can't see. It has ears, but it can't hear. It has a nose, but it can't smell. And he says, so you're confounded because you can't make your own god, because the god that actually is God's not just going to go away. He's the one that made the heavens. He's the one that makes the waters. Verse 18, they are vanity, the work of errors. In the time of their visitation, they shall perish. The portion of Jacob is not like them, for he is the former of all things, and Israel is the rod of his inheritance. The Lord of hosts is his name. Why is this passage here? He's talking about Babylon, he's talking about Persia, he's talking about politics, he's talking about war, and then in the middle of that it says, God made the world. Okay, how Bible-ish to just throw that in the middle of a chapter. But God is describing his dominion. That's what he's doing. So remember Job, remember the book of Job? Job is suffering. And he doesn't know why. He lost everything. Super rich, super wealthy, super nice, super good. He lost everything. Nobody knows why. So he has a group of his friends come by and try to explain to him why. Job, it's because you're a terrible person. And you just don't know why. To which Job replies, you are terrible comforters. That's what you are. If I am so bad, then I've been judged. So just let it be. I've been judged. Leave me alone. He basically says that in the book several times. But then Job demands from God an answer. I will go to his throne and that he will respond to me in the last chapter that he speaks in the book. And so God does come and respond to him. And you know what God doesn't do? Answer his question. We never find out why he suffered. And we know the part from heaven where he talks to Satan and all of that. But you know what's significant about that? it still doesn't even answer our question why he allowed them to suffer. Satan says, well, if you get rid of all his things, then he won't serve you anymore. God's like, okay. And we're like, why did he do that? That's the point. We're not fully understanding why, and Job certainly doesn't understand why. And then God speaks for four chapters, and he never tells him why. You know what he does say? I made the heavens. And he describes all the things that he does. I feed the animals and I bring the rain. Can you do any of these things, Job?
No.
Okay. Well, then we have to just swallow the fact that God knows more than we do. And if he were to tell us why, we wouldn't understand it. Because we don't know enough stuff, because we are brutish in our knowledge compared to God. We can't wrap our minds around these things. And even if we could, we have to still recognize the fact that God is the one in charge. So yes, this passage is extremely appropriate in Jeremiah 51. Why does God get to do it? Because he's the one that made the world. We live in it. We get to be a part of the world that he makes. And so we have to recognize the fact that he's the one that's truly in control. God will do what he wants. I want you to look at this one last verse before we're done. Verse 29. The land shall tremble and sorrow, for every purpose of the Lord shall be performed against Babylon, to make the land of Babylon a desolation without an inhabitant. What God purposes, he will do. Isaiah chapter 46 says this, remember the former things of old, for I am God, there is none else. I am God, there's none like me, declaring the end from the beginning and from ancient times, the things that are not yet done, saying, my counsel shall stand, and I will do all my pleasure. So in this passage where we see this great nation fall, this passage frames the whole historical moment saying, God's the one that does what he wants. That's a really bad place to stop because it kind of goes together with point two. We're gonna look at point two. God does what he wants, but men choose how they react to it. We choose how we react to God's dominion in this world. We want to be in charge. Now, God has given us to have dominion over this world. He tells man that in Genesis chapter 1. But there's a balance between him having given this world a gift to make and to subdue and to make it good, and the fact that we don't always, and God is still the king. Did you notice how he calls himself that? When he talks to Nebuchadnezzar, he says, thus saith the king, the Lord of hosts. At the end of the day, God is still in charge, and we live in that world that he's given to us. And we choose how we react to God's dominion. So we're going to look at that point number two as we finish up.